and welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name is Adrian Reynolds. I'm head of National Ministries, and I'm here with John Stevens, our National Director. Hello, John.
Hi, Adrian.
It's our regular roundup of the news. We're one twerp short, as just to quote Blackadder there. Phil is not here with us today. He is off looking after his daughter while his wife attends the, let me get it right, the FIEC Ministry Wives Retreat, which is going on at the moment. Been going on this week, hasn't it, John?
That's great.
Important part of our programme.
Two conferences this week. We've had Thrive, which has been for women's workers,
yep.
And UCOO, Hannah Hutchison, was able to be at that as well. And then second half of the week, support for pastors' wives, led by our two kind of directors for women's ministry, so Eleanor McGowan and Rachel. And we're just delighted that we've had good numbers who have come to those kind of events, good reports of how encouraged they've been.
Yeah. They happen every year, and you might think, well, the next one's a year away, which it is. But actually, if you're going to organise childcare, things like that, it's worth planning ahead. Just see if you can find time for either women's workers in your church or a ministry wife to come along. That'll be a great part of their growth and development and just spiritual care. Now, we're here to talk about the news. And so I think we'd start talking about Europe. John, if that's right, we've just come back from Poland, you and I. We've been at the European Leadership Forum in Wisła. I think that's how it's pronounced, in the south, could do my little compass, never eat shreddy wheat, southwest of Poland. Just tell us what the European Leadership Forum is, John.
Yeah, the Leadership Forum, this was a conference, which is a gathering of about 700 or so leaders from across Europe. They really bring leaders together, and the goal is to encourage them and envision them for the work of the gospel across Europe. The vision of the forum is to want to renew the biblical church across Europe. Recognition that there are many places in Europe where there are tiny numbers of evangelicals, it's a struggle.
And no resources.
And no resources, yeah. So Southern Europe, which has been predominantly Catholic, Eastern Europe, which is communist and Orthodox, Scandinavian countries and Germany, where liberalism has been rife. Actually, in world terms, places where there is a need for the gospel, behind kind of the Islamic world and Japan, Europe is really then the least evangelized sort of continent of the world. So that's the vision. And it's not just a conference. The conference is part of it. But through the year, there are all sorts of kind of groups, mentoring, other sort of more dedicated, focused events for people at different aspects of ministry, like, for example, apologetics. And so it's seeking all year round to equip and encourage leaders for the work of the gospel. And you and I were both leading networks there. So I was leading a network for leaders of Christian organizations, thinking about the skills of organizational leadership. We had a group of about 45 leaders from across Europe, helping them to think about how they can run their churches and organizations biblically. Adrian, what were you leading?
So I was leading a foundations network. It's for the first time is really to think about some of the basics of leadership. And again, yeah, people from all across Europe, and just greatly encouraging, wasn't it, to hear people's stories, to realize actually that most people are ministering across Europe with very, very little in the way of either access to resources or indeed money. So I met a Hungarian pastor, part of a network of churches, very, very similar actually in many ways to the FIEC. And he said, well, we're one of the larger churches in the network. I said, well, what size are you? And he said, we're about 45 members. And it's just a reminder that there are lots of really good things going on, but it's tough actually being in ministry across Europe. We think we have it tough, but actually we're greatly blessed, aren't we, in the UK?
We are, and I think that's why we're particularly keen to want to serve there, is we've got much to give to those in Europe. It's always humbling to learn from their example of faith and service. I think one of the things that struck me this year was virtually everybody I talked to was speaking about growth or encouragement, church planting.
Right.
So I heard about church planting in Athens, which was really encouraging, church planting in Italy. I heard about church planting in Gdansk and growing churches that were there. So actually, the mood felt remarkably encouraged in terms of God being at work. It's obviously a day of small things at this point, but there is significant kind of gospel growth going on, I think, amongst a younger generation of pastors and leaders. It's also great to meet people running organizations like FIEC. So lots of the churches are free evangelical churches. I spent some time with the guy who's going to be leading essentially the equivalent of the FIEC in Slovakia. And there were some people from around the world this time. So I met a kind of a Nigerian leader who has basically established an FIEC.
Is that a bit like Australia being allowed to be in Europe?
That's
kind of the same sort of concept.
But he was talking about how they've established essentially an FIEC in northern Nigeria, reaching Muslim communities and villages, and saying they're seeing 400 or 500 Muslim conversions a year through that work. So that's just wonderfully encouraging.
There's quite a few people from the FIEC involved in it as well. So the music team were from Above Bar. You run your network alongside Jen Charteris, who's part of an FIC church. Dan Strange was there as part of the Theology Network. So it's a lot, quite a few people from FIC churches serving. I guess there aren't so many people from the UK who go as attendees. Should some of the FIC church leaders and people serving in churches think about being there as somewhere to go to be blessed?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great opportunity. I mean, there's sort of all different sorts of fields covered, as I said, apologetics, Bible teaching, leadership, the arts, children's work, youth ministry. I think it'd be fair to say that actually in the UK, we have resources for lots of those things home. So I think for many of the people in Europe, this is a unique resource that's available to them. And it does remind us that actually a lot of training is available in the UK. Having said that, I think there is great benefit in actually learning from other cultures and how they're doing things, so that sometimes stepping outside of your own immediate context to think about a different context and how they do things can cause you to think of things freshly.
Yeah.
And maybe realize that much of what you do might actually be a result of tradition. Mm. You might have failed to contextualize because you've taken that for granted. So I think there is benefit in learning from those coming out of different contexts. Yeah, yeah. Who can put things into perspective and maybe provoke you to think differently.
Yeah, it always challenges me where we draw the boundaries, you know, because you have to think all the time about the people you're serving. And they might be serving in not only a different context, but a different kind of church. And actually, it's just good to be able to get beyond that, isn't it, sometimes? And I just find it a very humbling thing. Now, I don't know if you noticed this, but as we were driving back to the airport, the speed limit on the motorway was 140 kilometres an hour. Which is almost 90 miles an hour. So it's a pretty high speed limit, I noticed. Although I did also notice that as the speed limit went down to 70, the car kept going at 140 kilometres an hour. So clearly it's not hugely enforced. Which brings us to the question of speeding tickets. Tale of two speeding tickets. It's a while since we've had an in the news. So since we last met in the news, two speeding tickets have been in the news. The first is that issued to the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was caught doing 25 in a 20 zone along the embankment, and he didn't make a court appearance. He kind of pleaded remotely, didn't he? But pleaded guilty. And then a slightly more infamous, perhaps, incident with Suella Braverman and the speeding course that wasn't. Tell us, John, a little bit about the kind of background to these.
Yeah, well, they've both been caught speeding. I think the reality is that obviously, speeding covers a wide spectrum. The law is clear as to what should be done. I think they were both caught actually sort of exceeding a relatively low speed limit and would both say that they hadn't known what the speed limit was, or they weren't aware that they were breaching it. So it's very different from the person who's kind of deliberately...
Yes, doing 100 on the M1, you know what you're doing. Yeah.
So that's different. But it's a reminder that actually ignorance is no defence before the law, that actually in these contexts, actually the standard is set. And irrespective of whether you know you're breaking the standard or not, actually that renders you accountable, which is just a reminder that actually with sin and with God, he sets his standards. And in a sense, our knowledge and acceptance of those standards isn't the basis on which we're judged. We'll be held account for having kind of fallen short. And that's with a view to protect kind of everybody, everyone safe. It's difficult to dig down into the exact circumstances, but the Archbishop of Canterbury, it seems as though he attempted to kind of, he accepted that he'd sped and he wanted to resolve this.
He put his hands up, didn't he?
It ended up in court because apparently his attempts to kind of pay the fine and do that seemed not to have been accepted. There were some very strange communications with Lambeth Palace.
Dear Arch.
I feel a measure of sympathy for him as to where it ended up, because if the story is as it's been reported, apparently he did attempt to resolve this and it kind of then escalated. So there isn't an indication on his part of a desire to want to try to escape liability for that. With the other,
still a good headline though, isn't it?
Still a good headline. Yeah. With Suella Braverman, I think the really interesting thing there is, again, she accepts that she sort of was speeding and she was offered two alternatives, which is now standard practice for very kind of minor infringements of speeding, which is a sort of a speeding awareness course, which you have to pay to go on, but doesn't lead to points on your license, but you have to do it with other people, or you can accept the three penalty points, which will have implications for your kind of insurance premiums for a number of years. She wanted, in a sense, a private speeding course, because she didn't want to be sort of with other people. She didn't want to be noticed. She didn't want it to be a public story. So at one level, she wanted to, in a sense, almost find a way of hiding the fact that she had been caught and not kind of associate with people in an ordinary way. And there's been some controversy over the extent to which she wanted to draw in civil servants to help with that. Yeah. And then chose to take the points rather than the course because it would remain that privacy. So I think the really interesting thing there is the desire to be private, for it not to be known, to in a sense not have other people kind of recognize you. So there's a measure of might be shame, but it's more likely to be kind of public relations and not wanting to be exposed in that way.
Yeah. And much has been made of whether that is, you know, whether she broke the ministerial code in terms of trying to get people to give her special treatment and that sort of thing. Is that just a non-story, or is there more to it than that, do you think?
Well, I don't really know about the ministerial code issue. It seems as though the Prime Minister has decided not to take action on that. Yeah. And I think from our perspective, it is this sort of a reminder that justice in the end needs to be done publicly and not done in private and not done in secret. And that people, no matter who they are, should not be entitled to special treatment that enables them to escape the consequences of their actions. So almost there are two elements there. Whether she's misused her government position, I think, is for those who are aware of what the ministerial code requires to investigate. I think the bigger picture is here is what looks like a common pattern in life, which is that people who are powerful, people who are celebrities, people who are rich, have an expectation that they will be treated differently and that they will be able to avoid the ordinary consequences of their action when they've fallen short.
It's quite difficult to get down to people's motives, isn't it, in these situations? Because a lot hinges on, you know, what was the motive behind something? I mean, even when it comes to speeding, no, was someone doing something deliberately and knowingly, or was it accidental? I guess in Bible terms, was it sin with a high hand or not? And actually, it is very difficult to judge that, isn't it? I mean, sometimes circumstance, you know, does allow you to make a judgment, as we were talking about. If you're driving 100 on the motorway, it's almost certainly that you know exactly what you're doing. But 25 in a 20, it's very difficult to make a judgment about motives, which is why I think sometimes we think that the way that we can hide our motives from one another somehow also affects the way we can hide our motives from God. But of course, he sees everything, doesn't he? And that's I think that's the sobering thing about the gospel, and that the gospel reality, or the reality that the gospel kind of reveals, is that actually you could even do the right things, but if you do them for the wrong motive, then the Lord still sees.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything is evident to God. I do think as well in our culture, we've got this idea that my motive is what determines whether I'm really guilty or not. And I went, sin doesn't kind of quite work like that. The Bible's got two categories. There's kind of sort of iniquity and transgression. There's sort of falling short of God's standard. So God has set an objective standard. And to some extent, because we're created in his image, we have an awareness of what that standard is. And if we fall short of that standard, we're guilty before him, almost irrespective of our motives, almost irrespective of how hard we might have tried or otherwise, we've still fallen short of the standard. Transgression is another category, which is a deliberate crossing of a boundary. And actually, the way the law works is the law reveals what sin is so that our falling short is turned into conscious transgression. Yeah. So there's a sense in which the more we know God's standards, the more we're aware of our guilt, but it doesn't actually make us more culpable before God. It doesn't in a sense make things sin that weren't otherwise. That's why we need forgiveness. I mean, interestingly, in both of these cases, the penalty had to be paid.
Do you think, this is a question perhaps just for our own heart, are we very casual about speeding? I mean, it is illegal to speed. And yet I've been in lots of cars with Christian leaders driving at extraordinary speeds. Are we too casual about that? Just think actually it's essentially law that doesn't matter, and we start making the categories. Is that right?
I think there's a danger of that. And I think, you know, many of us grew up in an era in which there weren't speed cameras. It wasn't sort of likely that you were going to be a kind of caught. And we all have a temptation to think that we know what's best. We know what's safe. We want to make our own judgments.
That's at the root of it, isn't it?
So it reveals our degree of autonomy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there is a difference between the kind of the person who has totally ignored the law, and in a lot of instances, people who have been caught out because they weren't aware what the speed limit was.
Yeah.
So again, I
weren't paying attention.
Robert Jenrick, the minister, was banned for driving for six months.
Right.
He was driving at 68 on the M1, but actually it was one of those controlled motorways and the speed limit had been reduced to 40. Mm. And he would say, I wasn't aware that it had been reduced to 40. I was driving at 68, which was less than what I thought the speed limit was on the motorway, but he had still exceeded the speed limit by nearly 30 miles an hour. So again, yes, we mustn't be casual. These rules are given not to restrict us, but actually for the benefit of society as a whole. I mean, anybody on a speeding course will be shown the difference of impact and consequence if you hit a pedestrian below the speed limit and above the speed limit. That's what it's for.
My favourite comment was from Eddie Marson. I don't know if you saw this. He's a famous actor. And he wrote to, I think, The Times, or one of the newspapers, and said that he could understand Suella Braverman's reluctance, because he went on a speed awareness course And he found it extraordinarily distressing because no one recognized him. And there we go. he thought he was more famous than he was. Let's move on and talk a little bit about Joshua Sutcliffe. This is a subject which we perhaps need to come back to because it has extraordinary ramifications for how we live as Christians and speak as Christians, and especially for us as ministers of the gospel. And those of us who are leaders in churches, how we encourage people in our churches who might be involved in public life in some way. Lots of people in our churches might work in the medical professions or might work as teachers or any sort of context where they perhaps are thinking, can I talk about Jesus or not? So just tell us a little bit about Joshua Sutcliffe. He's a teacher. This is actually going back to events that happened in 2017. So in some ways, it's kind of an old story, but it's only just come to a head now, hasn't it?
Yeah, Joshua Sutcliffe is a teacher who's been banned by the regulatory authority for teachers from teaching in the future, subject to possibly a review in a couple of years' time. The heart of the issue is that he's a Christian who obviously sort of passionately disagrees with transgender ideology. So what he was banned from teaching because he had on a number of occasions misgendered a pupil. Yeah. So
which was the head? Those are the headlines we've seen.
Those are the headlines that we've seen. Yeah. And that was seen to not sort of, in a sense, be respecting the dignity of the pupil. It was contrary to the policies of the school. So that's the headline story. So it kind of immediately appears as, you know, here is Christian being mistreated or kind of victimized in some way for having stood for their belief about the truth. I think these are incredibly complex cases and we need to recognize that. I mean, actually, I'm on our podcast. I mean, this is an FIEC podcast, but an awful lot of what we talk about is not FIEC policy. No, we're just trying to reflect on these issues. And this is exactly an area in which evangelical Christians will have a disagreement of view. So his view was, I will not use the pronouns that the person wants to choose.
Yeah, which many of us might have some sympathy with.
He obviously felt that that was kind of being required to lie in some way. And there's a big debate at the moment amongst evangelicals as to whether or not they should do that. So Rosaria Butterfield, who's a famous kind of lesbian, become Christian, she has recently made very clear she won't use pronouns of people's choice. Matthew Roberts, Presbyterian minister in England, has written a new book called Pride, in which he kind of says that he's happy to use people's chosen names but wouldn't use pronouns.
Is there just is there a mismatch there?
Well, I find that a difficult line to draw, but on one level, I think there's an idea there that the pronoun is saying something ontological about a person, actually is declaring that they're male or female, whereas names are just chosen. So this is some sort of cultural convention of the difference between names and pronouns there. But that very difference is the reason why evangelicals might take a different view. Mm-hmm. So if you use a person's chosen pronouns, are you really falsely witnessing against their ontology, or is that just a linguistic convention of how people speak to each other? So there's a massive issue there to be worked through, and evangelical Christians may well take different views as to what the right thing is to do in
that
may
of course present it, that may be for us as leaders, that just to pause there a moment, that might not just be how we equip people to live in the world. That might be an issue right in the church. If someone comes into church, we're gonna have to face up to those sorts of questions, aren't we? We can't ignore
those. I read the judgment. I mean, I think it's absolutely right in a secular culture where these things are being debated, where policy is changing. Christians have the right to assert their rights and actually to take action to seek to uphold their rights. So part of this is about the question of, do you have the right to do that in that context? This first judgment concluded that the teacher didn't have the right to do that. Right. He's got the right to appeal to the High Court, so it will go further.
But there's some positive things in it for Christians.
I mean, the story is bigger than that. So when you read the judgment, this was a teacher who was working in a school. He was a maths teacher. He clearly exercised some Christian witness within the school. Mm. So he was allowed by the school to run a Bible club that people could come to. So it was known as a Christian. And in the end, what the tribunal found was that he'd crossed the boundary in his maths lessons and dealings with these people of being sort of a preacher rather than a teacher.
And that was the language they used.
The language that they used. And some interesting things. So one of the claims made against him was that he had said that he was against gay marriage. Mm. And it was alleged that that was, again, a breach of the teacher's code. The judgment finds that, so when he was asked questions, what's your view on gay marriage, by pupils, and he answered, that was regarded as being perfectly acceptable. He'd been asked the question.
In the context of the classroom.
Indeed, so the freedom to answer and express your opinion.
So that's sort of the 1 Peter 4. Always be ready to give a reason in that particular context. He was free to do that.
Indeed. Whereas actually when he sort of in a sense talked about his view on gay marriage uninvited, that was seen as crossing the line.
Right.
from teaching because of the impact on potentially LGBTQ students who might be there. So that's quite an interesting navigation. Yeah. You're not restrained from saying what you think, but there's a difference between proactivity in that and the context in which yes. you might speak.
So have you done that in the Bible Club? Would that would be different?
Well, I think that's right, because people yeah. have chosen to come there.
Yeah, okay,
and
right,
they know what they're coming to. Similarly, he played a video in a maths lesson that was about masculinity. And again, I think it was the inappropriateness of doing that in that particular context. Having said that, he was also critiqued for things that he'd put on his own YouTube channel about homosexuality, about Islam. Mm. Again, because that wasn't referencing the school, because that was personal, that wasn't regarded as being contrary to kind of professional conduct in the school context. So there are some ways in which the...
But there have been other cases, haven't there, where that's yeah. not been... See, there have been some cases, haven't there, maybe I've got this wrong, where people have put things on their Facebook posts and they have been picked up on that because of the connection to work.
I can't instantly comment in detail on all of those, but often that may be because it is linked to work in some way or references to it.
Okay.
On the transgender issue, what the tribunal found was that on a number of occasions, both in a group where this pupil was part of the group and also speaking to them personally, he had sort of deliberately not used the chosen pronouns, despite school policy and despite that the fact that that was what both the pupil and the pupil's parents wanted in that situation. And it was the parents who complained that that was not respecting the dignity of the child and was harming them. And again, this is very complex because he clearly believed that enabling the child to identify as a different gender was itself harmful to the child.
Yeah.
We've seen things like the reporting to GIDS in which children have suffered harm because they've been put on a pathway towards becoming transgender. But it does raise the question, does a teacher, is it your job in that context to contradict what the parents and the person wants, to in effect defend them kind of from themselves? Mm. And in many cases, we just have to remember these are incredibly vulnerable kind of sort of children. And maybe that's not the context in which that issue is to be picked up. And I think we can easily confuse the issue and how we deal with particular individuals. Mm. There was also the fact that I think quite significantly, given that this had happened, there was a disciplinary hearing. The teacher then appeared on the television.
During the hearing?
Well, actually a couple of days before his disciplinary hearing. And one of the things particularly picked up on is he'd misgendered the pupil. I think it was on This Morning on ITV, on television, and enough details about who they were to enable their identity to be guessed by people who were watching it. And again, that was seen as a particular crossing of the boundary.
So it seems to me that we operate in several different Bible categories here, don't we? And we mustn't set one above the other. So there is courage and there is boldness, but there's also wisdom and kindness and gentleness. You know, we are to make the most of every opportunity, but to do so with wisdom. So that there are lots of different categories, and we mustn't just, you know, major on one and think that all the others don't matter.
I think that's completely right. And as we live in a society which has got a very different outlook from Christianity, and that has changed over the last 50 years, part of this is coming to terms with being in that kind of situation. There's that balance of standing for truth and being faithful witnesses to what we believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
But does that mean that we have to always confront what the world does and what the world believes that's wrong in every situation? And I think, to me, we then have to reflect on things like Daniel working for King Nebuchadnezzar, being an administrator within the Babylonian government, being taught everything that kind of the Babylonians believed, Babylonian magic, Babylonian gods.
Babylonian food.
Babylonian food. Where do you draw the line? And you don't get the impression that Daniel opposed everything that was happening at every point. It would have been contrary to kind of what God said, because otherwise he would have been unable to function and serve in the roles that he was given. But there were points at which he said, I will not do that. And I think navigating that issue of what that is, it is incredibly complex.
Well, let's come back to that, because that's such an important topic at another time. But just thinking about wisdom, thinking about gentleness as well, leads me to want to talk to you about Tim Keller. Mm. Lots of deaths, actually, in the last couple of weeks of very well-known people. But in the Christian world, perhaps the most significant one is the passing of Tim Keller at a relatively young age and been battling cancer for some time. I think I'm of a generation, I guess you are as well, where we're heavily influenced by Tim Keller, by his particular kind of apologetics, making a case for God and doing that in a very winsome, engaging way. What are some of your reflections on the ministry and the influence of Tim Keller here in the UK, John?
Yeah, I mean, I think Tim Keller has had a huge influence here in the UK. And I think we benefited hugely from how he helped us to think about ways of communicating the gospel to postmodern people, particularly those who are perhaps educated postmodern people, younger postmodern people, the kind of New York context in which he ministered. And I think I had probably been brought up with a very strong emphasis on the importance of expository Bible teaching, which was really valuable and great. I think what Tim Keller added to that was a greater emphasis on contextualization and thinking about who you're speaking to and how to connect the gospel with them and how to connect the gospel with their needs. So I think he modeled for us how to bring the gospel to bear on people and kind of highlight how the gospel connects with their lives, so that the gospel is not only confrontational, but also kind of engaging and fulfilling their aspirations and their desires. And I think he did that in a remarkable way. I think not everybody is going to agree with absolutely everything Keller would have said, and that's true of just about every Christian leader who will take their view. I think he is commendable for having stood for the truth of the gospel. He connected, but he didn't compromise on that. I do think he had a passionate commitment to evangelical unity and to wanting being generous and kind to people, and he built unity as a result of that. There were some who felt that he was not confrontational enough and disagreed with him on that. But I think I value his generosity of spirit and the Gospel Coalition and working together with those who held quite different theological views, but standing together on the core is a real model of fostering that kind of
and that spirit. I mean, he was invited to speak at the parliamentary prayer gathering here in the UK, it's a relatively recent thing, and had the opportunity to preach a gospel. You can find the audio online, to many parliamentarians, unsaved parliamentarians. And actually, if he had been more confrontational, he would never have been offered that invitation. So it's interesting that actually, it's a bit going back to Daniel, actually choosing your moments, taking wise lines does give you opportunities.
I mean, I think in some ways the lesson from Keller for us to learn, the danger with all leaders is people think they see what they do and they just copy what they do. And I do think Keller's ministry was very targeted on a particular demographic, a particular cultural context. Many of our churches are not operating in kind of metropolitan New York with that constituency. And I think, therefore, what you need to do is not just simply do what he did, but it's more about thinking about why he did what he did. And the methodology and how he got there is actually the key thing that we can learn from. Because if you're ministering in a very different context, actually the way you might preach the gospel could look very different, but you're essentially using the same methodology to get there. And I think that's a great danger for kind of gospel ministers. Whenever they hear others that they like and whose ministry they appreciate, is they can tend to think, I just have to copy that.
Yes, and end up being a poor imitation, which isn't even the right thing.
And it just doesn't work where they are. And the reason is because the person has done such a good job of contextualizing the gospel for where they
are. John, that explains why I don't see you in your black polo neck very often. It's not really where we are, is it? One of the things that Tim Keller, of course, is famous for is really focusing on idolatry as a paradigm. We could have an argument, I guess, about whether that's the only paradigm in terms of the sin portfolio, but actually that was a big thing for him, is identifying idols. And I just wanted to end by talking about a couple of idols, because it's just interesting. An idol that we hardly ever talk about, pets. Now, I don't know how you feel about pets, John. Do you know there are 54 million pets in the UK?
I didn't know that, Adrian.
33 million of them are fish.
Whoa.
And I wonder how much of those are pets or just meals in waiting. I don't know. Anyway, 54 million pets. The reason this is in the news is because Pets at Home announced their annual results yesterday. They have 54% of the market, which is worth something like £7 billion in the UK, grooming your pets and caring for them. How do you feel about pets? I don't think I've seen you out walking your hamster?
No. We are not massively pet people.
You're not? Okay.
I have had pets over my lifetime. My collection of pets, I was thinking about what I had. Stick insects, terrapins, tortoises, rabbit and hamsters.
Is none of those are great for a walk.
No, they're
really
not great.
And I did read yesterday a pastor saying that that getting a dog is the best evangelistic thing he'd ever done.
Oh, yeah, because people clearly stop and talk with each other. And I can sort of, I mean, at one level, that's sort of a utilitarian reason for having a pet in some sense, but it's certainly many of
an idol, do you think? Can they become idols?
Well, certainly almost anything can become an idol. You talk about pets. I happened to read an article in the paper this week about somebody who was talking about having spent thousands of pounds on a hysterectomy for their guinea pig and why it was worth
guinea pig?
Guinea pig, absolutely, because they had this sort of great relationship with their guinea pig.
I know we should sort of remain impartial, but I can't help a little guffaw at that point.
I mean, there are things in creation which are good and to be enjoyed.
Yeah.
And actually, I think in this whole issue of idolatry, one of the challenges is navigating, am I enjoying a good gift that God has given? Or am I worshipping something and investing it with a significance of bringing salvation and blessing to me that actually really ought to be God's only? So I think sometimes using the language of idolatry can be unhelpful because we can then almost feel guilty about anything that we enjoy. Yeah. But yes, people can sort of seek in effect salvation, blessing, fulfillment from these things rather than enjoying them simply as the good gifts God has given. Yeah. And I guess the fact that people like pets, they serve different functions, don't they? For some people, pets are comfort.
Yes.
So actually, pets are companionship. Yeah. Often they're undemanding, unlike people. And they love that about them. They feel they get unconditional love from their pets. Mm. To some extent, that's a slight deception at some point. So your cat really doesn't love you in quite that way, but you feel
your terrapin. However, I can't believe you had a terrapin.
I was reading that somebody had a sort of an emu, which was there to kind of
an emu
to bring comfort. And actually, therapeutic value of animals going into hospitals and all people's homes is well recognized.
Yeah.
And then for others, animals are a projection of themselves. So we read regularly in the papers terrible stories about dogs that attack people and kill them, often a kind of version of an American pit bull. And you feel that for some people, their pet is a kind of a projection of strength. So people own animals for all sorts of different reasons. I'm not sure the Bible's particularly hot on pets. You don't get the great deal of sense that in the
you
Old
heard
Testament,
it here
animals
first.
Were
the Bible
given
is
to
not
be
hot
pets.
On pets.
I was wrestling whether I could think of any example of a biblical pet. And I'm not sure I easily could, actually.
Answers on it. Is there a prize? Is there a pets at home? Perhaps we should offer a pets at home voucher. The pets in the Bible. We need to finish there, John. We'll finish with pets. I love animals, so do you. Don't write in. Other idols are available. Thank you very much for joining us. This has been Independence, the FIEC podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, do rate us, review, just smash that like button, as they say, and that'll help us be found by other people. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch up with you again soon. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Adrian.